Welcome back to the Lars Resort. Still a podcast with me, Lars Sivertsen. Still brought to you by Betsson. We are still covering the Euros very, very closely indeed, and doing a pod every single match day this summer. Today is a thing that happened. This will not be a short one, I don't think, because England left us with many, many things to discuss. Now, but before we get to that, on the comments of me breaking out the B word a bit yesterday about having my first sort of slightly, this was a bit dull, Euros day, we got a tweet from Dave Mitchell on Twitter, who is one, I think I've said it before, one of the, if the resort had like a lounge, like airports have, where like if you're a frequent flyer with an airline, they let you into the lounge. I currently have that with Lufthansa, by the way. It's been a busy year. If there's like a frequent flyer lounge if there is that in the resort, Dave is definitely in there. Like, he's not only just hanging out in the lounge at all times, he's one of the most frequent of flyers. And he also, I believe he's massive, he's got a big The Witcher tattoo, and once completely destroyed his leg again. So, like, me and Dave, we've got a lot in common. I don't actually have a Witcher tattoo, I'm just saying he has some kind of solid nerd credentials. That's what I'm saying. Anyway, Dave writes, this is a good observation. I don't think you're wrong about the dreaded B word. I think we'll see a few of them in game week two. The best third place thing made the first game free hits for people. In game week two, there are tons of teams going, draw this and win the last game, just don't get knocked out. And there are also lots of teams that have won already going, draw suits us too, basically through with that. Only teams like Belgium, Croatia, and Ukraine really have slash had to make big moves now. I think that is dead on from Dave. It's another example of this tournament format not being amazing. Like, we're playing so many games to get rid of, what, 8 teams in the tournament? But, I mean, the games are fun. The games are fun. And as we've talked about, the bracket really matters. So whether you finish first or second or as one of the third place finish, that has a big, like, effect on how your prospects for going further in the tournament. So it does matter, but it does feel like an awful lot of football to eliminate not that many teams. And for the reasons Dave just said, it makes sense that some of these second games will be a little bit cagey. Quite a lot of people who are happy with the draw. Are the Serbians one of those teams that are happy with the draw? I mean, they probably wouldn't have said so this morning when they woke up and said, yeah, we'll take a draw against Slovenia. But of course, they're still in the tournament. They're not home yet. But Serbia, Slovenia, not going to spend a ton of time on this, except to say that the first half was, I mean, Serbia were really bad. I mean, I'm just very disappointed by Serbia here. It's very obvious looking at their team again what their big strength is going to be, which is they have not one, but they've got two big, strong strikers who are dangerous in the air and playing with wingbacks. So clearly the idea is to get the ball wide and put some good, good crosses in. And they didn't do much of that, I didn't think, in the first half. Really, the sort of 40th minute was the first time they really got into some good crossing positions and suddenly created a bit of danger. And there was a bit of life from the Serbians towards the end of the half. But you started wondering if maybe the Serbians were a little bit too afraid of losing, didn't want to push up, didn't want to risk anything. Second half, again, they got into some better crossing positions. They had two early crosses early in the half that immediately sort of led to danger. I mean, I'm a little bit obsessed with this Serbian crosses thing, but again, it's such a luxury to have two big number nine. So many teams in the tournament don't really have one. Like, the Croatians would absolutely love to borrow. Could they just go, like, either Mitrovic or Vlahovic, like, one of them. Could we just, like, play them instead of Bruno Petkovic up front? We'd be much better off. Anyway, Sesko was looking dangerous down the other end, as you expect. He's a very, very good player. But they give away a lead, 1-0 Slovenia, and with the defense just falling asleep completely. No one tracking the run on the far post. And Serbia do kind of react. I mean, Mitrovic is so close to equalizing in the 71st minute, which would have been nice for us, since he was one of our, you know, backed goal scorers. Another good crossing position. Mitrovic hits the bar. But again, quite not that long after they score, Slovenia again have a big chance, because there's just no one defending down the Serbian left-hand side. Towards the end, Serbia were pushing people forward. They were trying, but again, I'm not. They were a bit of a rabble, really. A lot of sort of uncoordinated stuff, chaotic, sort of some bad. Again, the crosses increasingly bad. And when they got the equalizer right at the death, I mean, that's dramatic and exciting. And the goalkeeper was up, and in fairness, they had pushed Slovenia back. I just never thought they looked impressive here, and I didn't feel like they really deserved it. It felt really harsh on Slovenia. And I really sort of transitioned here from being disappointed to almost angry with Serbia, because again, this team has a lot of good individual talent players who play at good clubs or have played at good clubs and are kind of respected for the work they've done in club football. Just thought the teamwork across the board was pretty bad, not well coordinated. Also thought there was a kind of arrogance to their performance, like the way just, I think it was Milinkovic-Savic who just didn't track his runner at all from the Slovenian goal. Like, it was clearly his man, and he went in from the back post, and Milinkovic-Savic was like, this seems like someone else's problem, I guess. It's not as if I've played central midfield for much of my career, and I should be familiar with the concept of tracking a runner into the box. Just kind of left him. And then a few minutes later, like I said, they had another chance down the same flank, and there's just no one there. Very complacent and not well coordinated and just disappointed over what Serbia brought here. I mean, they do have the individual quality to lift themselves, but those are two very, very disappointing performances for the Serbs. And I really feel for Slovenia. They have been more than the sum of their parts in two games now, and will probably still be going home in the group stage, which feels like a shame. Shame for them. Denmark-England. Yeah. Where do you begin? So, Southgate fielded an unchanged lineup for England for the first time in the last 16 games. The last time Southgate didn't make any changes was between the round of 16 and the quarterfinals of the World Cup in Qatar. Since then, he's always kind of fiddled and made little changes, which I thought was kind of interesting. It meant another game for Trent Alexander-Arnold in midfield. Not everyone too keen on that. It meant another go at making that Foden role position make sense. And Southgate said ahead of the game that they wanted to start like the last game, but then focus on keeping the ball a bit better, because he identified that that was one of the reasons why the Serbia game got away from them a little bit. And the background for Denmark is worth noting here, because the natives were getting a bit restless. There's been quite a lot of criticism of Kasper Juhlmann and the team after Slovenia, of course, but also just generally since the World Cup, which was a little bit of a disaster for them. They had a pretty easy qualifying group where they did kind of goofy things like lose to Kazakhstan and lose to Northern Ireland. And even the games they won, there were a lot of sort of not super convincing performances in there. So it had been a while since Denmark played a game that was impressive, that was good. So there wasn't a ton of optimism going into that, from my impression reading the Danish papers or online newspapers, at least. I didn't sit here with the paper editions of the... That would have been interesting, but like reading the Danish online media didn't seem to be a huge optimism going into this game. It wasn't the most thrilling encounter early on, but England, at least, they dominated possession. They kind of asserted themselves. They looked like the better team, even if they weren't like playing thrilling football the first 20 minutes. And the goal was kind of continues the trend of this tournament, is that goals are either like total bangers or sort of calamity defensive mishaps. You know, they dispossessed Denmark deep into their own box, got the ball into... They dispossessed Denmark in their own half, got down the flank, put the ball into the box where there was a defender, had an unlucky touch, it ends up with Harry Kane, and this is the thing that happens. And it's something that we're seeing in this tournament. You know, just get the ball into the box, man. Like, even if you can get lucky, you can hit someone's arm, you can go get an own goal out of it. Like, I think there's a lot of... you notice in these sort of tight games... When no team are really playing super well, sometimes if you just get the ball into the box often enough, then something will happen. Seems to be the way this tournament is going, and there's an element like you make your own luck with this. You know, if you put pressure on the opponent, then that's something that can happen. We saw Saka get clattered and Vestergaard get booked for taking him out. I mean, that was a tick off the bingo card for this game. Kind of, I did a thing for the Racing Post sort of previewing the game, and I did make the point that, like, Yannick Vestergaard, like, he moves with all the speed of a tectonic plate. So I kind of expected Saka to get a good run of him and Vestergaard getting booked. I mean, that should have been, like, a betting preview thing, Vestergaard to get booked in the game. Anyway, England did kind of the England thing. I got a message from our dear friend Peter Welpton, who just messaged me and said, I don't get it. Like, he just, why do England do this? Because I've double-checked the numbers here. Just so I have them. And in the first 18 minutes of the game, up until England scored, they had 62% possession. Denmark had 37% possession. So England were in control, 62.7 and 37.3. So England in control. Let's look at the numbers between England's goal and Denmark's equaliser. Let me just... Oh, look! Denmark had 74% possession suddenly. England just, oh, well, we have a goal now. We're just going to sit back, I guess. And they were all asked about this after the game. Is this something Gareth is telling you? It's like, no, that's absolutely not the plan. Just seems to happen sometimes. Sometimes it's something that happens. They just kind of sat back and let Denmark back into the game. Even so, I mean, the shot is, I haven't seen the XG on that shot. I imagine the XG on that shot from Ullmann is just the poop emoji or something. Like, that's not even a real number. But it was a wonderful strike. Again, only mishaps or total bangers seems to be allowed in this tournament. It reminded me about a little bit of Romania game when they got a goal. Denmark had been playing better after England's goal, but you could see they got a real lift when that went in. They looked more confident, more assertive. And England looked kind of rattled. They looked kind of rattled. And instead of, like, responding and striking back, I thought they started looking a little bit anxious. They started, like, they were missing more passes than they were earlier in the game. And started to look like bad England, I thought, in the first half. England finishing the half poorly, I write in my notes. Looking a bit anxious. Kane dropping off too much, question mark? Bellingham ineffectual is sort of what I was thinking going into halftime here. And the BBC pundits at halftime were getting very angsty. Always fascinating. You had Rio Ferdinand, you had Michael Richards, and you had Thomas Frank just holding up the Danish end of things in the BBC studio. And you could tell Gary Lineker, of course, being a presenter, he was also very angsty. Really focusing on the fact that England weren't playing with a sort of high press constantly, making the point that these players play in a sort of high pressing style for their clubs. Why are they not just doing this here? I would again contest that. In a summer tournament, when everyone has a super long season in their legs, if you want to try to go out and play like Jürgen Klopp-inspired, gegenpressing, heavy metal football for 90 minutes of every game, you're not going to go far in the tournament, because they're going to be absolutely shattered by the time you get to the knockouts. I mean, you can even see signs of England looking a little bit tired as it is, to be honest. Having said that, there is a balance to be struck here, and I did think England were a little bit too passive for my taste, even if I'm not expecting them to, like, do the full 3-second rule, super pressing, here we go type of thing. There is such a thing as being too passive as well. And there was a big chat about Foden's role. I mean, this has become... It's in danger of becoming a national obsession, I think. Rio Ferdinand, incredibly condescending towards Gareth Southgate at halftime. Because they showed a clip of Foden dribbling past a few players through the middle. And Southgate kind of saying, well, if you don't see now that this is where Foden needs to play, then I can't help you, or something like this. Which I really wonder if Rio Ferdinand would say that to Guardiola. If they had Guardiola in the studio, would he suggest that he's a buffoon and a fool for not playing Foden down the middle? Because for City, he's played, I think it's 35 games out on the wing on either side of the season, and 15 in the middle. So Guardiola, you know, even though it's blindingly obvious, says Rio Ferdinand, that he needs to play in the middle, Guardiola doesn't seem to think so. Of course, that is a little bit to do with City having Kevin De Bruyne and England not having that. But we'll get into more Foden stuff later. The Foden thing wasn't the thing that alarmed me the most in the first half. I was much more worried about the fact that Jude Bellingham just wasn't in the game, wasn't making an impact. And that is a problem, because we've talked about this before the tournament. There isn't, as brilliant as Foden is, he is much more of a guy who makes an impact in the final third than a sort of midfield orchestrator who knits everything together. You know, again, Saka's used to getting balls from Ødegaard, Foden's used to getting balls from KDB. Who is that character for England? And the only guy I'm really looking at in the squad, and I think the way he's positioned, it looks like Southgate is hoping for that as well, is Bellingham. And he was very good in the first half against Serbia. Not good at all in this game. Really not a factor, I didn't think. So that is a concern. If Bellingham isn't doing the business in that role, you're going to kind of struggle to build attacks, I think. And I was really missing Jack Grealish in this game. I don't know. Maybe I've got Grealish on the brain. I just thought, if you end up a little bit too deep, you're not keeping the ball well, people are a little bit anxious, a lot of bad touches and drop passes and stuff, and you're not able to progress the ball, that's stuff that Jack Grealish can help you with. Like, just get it to Jack Grealish. He can dribble someone. He can win a foul. He can move you up the field. I felt there was a real sort of... this would have been a good game for Grealish, I felt. It's interesting. Again, Southgate said ahead of the game, what he took away from the Serbia game is that they have to try to keep the ball better. That clearly wasn't happening at all. And I think it's fascinating to listen to England pundits, the English ones in particular, because they always, like, the answer is always play faster and quicker and press more and more passion and all this sort of stuff. stuff. I tend to go the other way and think England become a little bit too impatient when things go badly, and they kind of look for the quick ball forward too quickly instead of like moving it around a bit and getting comfortable, trying to maneuver some people out of position maybe, see if you can find some openings. They start sort of defaulting to trying to do things at 100 miles an hour, and we've kind of seen that be a problem for England in so many international tournaments before. And honestly, I was kind of missing the slick build-up play of Georgia. Okay, bearing in mind, Denmark a little bit better organized than Turkey were, to put it mildly. But I swear to God, I thought Georgia looked more comfortable in the build-up phase than England did at times here. But it was, I mean, the pundits were so angry at halftime. And Cher, Alan Cher on co-coms was just freaking out. I don't think I've ever heard him this angry. And I do wonder if people really get angry, not just because England were bad, but because they looked so much like the bad version of England that we've seen in international tournaments before, when they're not moving the ball well, passes aren't connecting, you can see the players start to get anxious and like little technical flaws are starting to creep in. I mean, it started to remind me of England before Southgate, like the sort of England when they were so beset by mental anguish or pressure or whatever that they suddenly couldn't do normal things on the pitch. Like, I always bring up the Iceland game as like the worst example of that. We weren't completely in Iceland territory here, but we were heading that way, really, and some of the technical flaws you saw them make. And they were and will be slaughtered for like being too defensive. That's the thing Southgate always gets criticized for. I think they did want to attack more. They just weren't able to progress the ball up the field. The passes were not connecting. They were not finding spaces. Denmark were really well organized. And there's a risk of me saying this over and over again because I've written it down so many times in my notes. England struggling to put passing moves together here. And they have players who can make an impact in the final third. We know that. But they need to get the ball there. And they weren't able to do that. And again, Jude Bellingham not getting a hold of this game at all. So when we're thinking about moving Foden into a more sort of dedicated central role, I don't necessarily think he will help you that much with this, but if you do get him into a central role, I think you're more likely to get him into like shooting positions. And he does have a very good goal scoring record when he does play there for City. Of course, playing for City is a very different thing. And I feel like generally the big problem Foden has is that he's so used to the system at City, where he knows where all the runs are coming, he knows where he's going to receive the ball, everything is so imprinted onto his brain that when he plays for England, it's like, what's happening here? Where is everyone? Why am I not getting the ball when I usually get the ball? Where is the guy who's meant to come there for the pass? Why is he not in this zone? Like, it looks like he's kind of struggles to be on the same frequency as everyone else, but he does have a good shot. You know, he's very clever technically. He can go past the man. So if you have him in central areas and slightly closer to the goal, maybe he can create some magic out of nothing. That's possible. And maybe he could have some kind of connection with Harry Kane. Kane can play these little 1-2s off him. Kane is pretty clever with that stuff. I mean, we think back to when he had that great connection with Dele Alli, for instance. Maybe that kind of vibe is something that England could develop. But it feels like a big swing to try to make that work suddenly in the middle of a tournament. Seems like something maybe they should have spent a couple of friendlies working on in the run-up to the tournament as an option. I don't know. But whatever you do with Foden, I do think there's a case to be made for trying Bellingham a little bit deeper against Slovenia, because in this game against Denmark they had such a problem progressing the ball from midfield, and Bellingham is a pretty good passer of the ball, pretty incisive, and he is also good at going past people, so you can progress it that way. So I think maybe that is something worth trying, even if it leaves the defense possibly a little bit more exposed. There was a big discussion about Kane's role, about whether he should be dropping off as much as he does. Maybe he needs to stay higher. But again, in a game like this, when they're not able to get the ball into the final third, I don't think it matters whether the striker is there or not, because they can't get the ball there. And on Kane, Jackie Oakley, I thought, made a good point on Twitter, which is, she says, I'm still convinced Harry Kane is labouring with that back injury he struggled with at the end of the season. They won't admit it, as it would play into the hands of the opposition, but it would be one explanation for his lack of mobility in this tournament, says Jackie Oakley. And I think that's an interesting point. And it does actually, it sounds plausible to me that he's not 100% fit, and it might also explain why Southgate brought both Watkins and Ivan Toney. Because if you play with one striker and Kane is going to play as much as he physically can, and you have Jared Bowen who can play up front in a pinch, it always seemed excessive to me to bring two specialist strikers. Like, Tony, do you really need him there? But if you go into the tournament knowing that Kane isn't 100% and that he's kind of powering through, and of course injuries that you're playing through could get worse, then having that extra forward in the squad makes a lot more sense. I do wonder if there's something there, if maybe we'll see Kane have like a sit-down interview after the Euro saying, oh yeah, you know, I was injured throughout or something. That wouldn't surprise me, really. And certainly England, as the second half progressed, were turning into, like, we had, it must have been very stressful for English people who have cheered on this team for so many tournaments and have seen them be bad in this exact way so many times. And I do wonder, that first 30 minutes against Serbia, when they kind of, they were all over them, and you know what, they actually looked after the ball very well. Maybe... was that a mirage? Was that like, did that fill everyone with false hope? Because as we saw earlier today, Serbia, not the most organized team. Maybe that was, again, Serbia being more of a rabble, I don't know. And with England, there are two problems that seems to haunt England in tournaments, in games like this. First of all, successive generation of England players have had talent, but they've kind of lacked sort of slick, clever passing midfielders. Like, where is the English Pirlo? Like, now, who is the English Rodri? Who's the midfielder who can kind of set the tempo and move the ball around? Or even the English Odegaard, slightly further up the field, slightly different type of vibe, but someone who can find those openings. They seem to not create those guys. There are a lot of people who think Foden can be that guy, but he's not really been that for City, and certainly it's something that hasn't been tried a lot at England. And if he's already struggling to find the right frequency with these guys, I'm not sure he can suddenly be the guy who's at the center of everything. That type of player, they've always seemed to lack, England. I really struggle to think, Michael Carrick maybe? But then he wasn't even regular for the national team. Like, this sort of deep, sort of ball distributor type, they always had a problem. There was a hope that Jack Wilshere would turn into that guy, but that never happened. So that's been a problem. I think there's a case for trying Adam Wharton, who does sort of move the ball very beautifully in the Crystal Palace midfield. Very inexperienced in this setting, but against Slovenia, you have some time. Let's maybe try that for an hour and see what happens. Because the Trent Alexander-Arnold thing, I think, is not working. But we also saw the risk with throwing in someone who's very inexperienced, because Eze came on, who, you know, I'm very, very fond of. He couldn't get into the game at all and kind of looked out of his depth. And yeah, Southgate is going to get a lot of criticism for this. And because that's kind of the job of the England manager, to be a kind of national pain sponge, to take the blame for absolutely everything that happens. And he talked after the game about needing to keep the ball better, which is true. That was a huge problem. It became a bigger problem as the game went on. But he also said one thing, and I guarantee you this is going to get clipped up and go viral on the internet, and he's going to be absolutely murdered by, like, banter accounts. Because he did say... I think it wasn't a question about Trent Alexander-Arnold, about the midfield. He said that we don't have a natural replacement for Calvin Phillips, and that this is a problem, which is completely true. Like, Henderson has aged out. Phillips has had a career downturn, so he's kind of out of the picture. And that is why they're trying Trent Alexander-Arnold next to Declan Rice, because none of the other midfield options are convincing or sufficiently experienced at this level. The two guys who they've been using there in recent years are unavailable or not, you know, plausible candidates right now. That's completely accurate thing to say. It's just that after a performance like that, if you come out talking about, oh, we don't have Calvin Phillips, people are just going to lose their minds. I don't think people are not mentally prepared to listen to Gareth Southgate talk about Calvin Phillips right now. I think the sort of the crying laughing emoji is going to be used at record levels. Can you imagine the banter of these sort of accounts that all seem to be run by 14-year-olds about, like, Southgate after that performance saying, oh, yeah, the problem is, you know, no Calvin Phillips, what can you do? So I wonder if that was like a bit of a... I think whoever is in charge of, like, PR and press relations at media just did a massive, like, was probably off camera slamming his head repeatedly against the wall going, no, don't say that, Gareth, god damn it. Anyway, but there is a serious question there. Who is playing next to Declan Rice? We talked about it in the build-up. They don't have a sort of... there's no Rodri type. There's no even... like, Fabian Ruiz was brilliant for Spain in the later game. And Jorginho would be lovely in there. But there's no guy who does that for England. Kobbie Mainoo might develop into that kind of player, but it seems very soon for him. Same with Wharton. I mean, I found myself in the second half... this is how, like, desperate I was for England to show any kind of quality on the ball in midfield. Thinking, should Ross Barkley have been in this squad? Maybe? I mean, and that is a stretch. Like, again, I don't think England are winning the Euros if we're sat here thinking Ross Barkley should probably have been in the squad. As much as he did some heroic things for Luton this season, I think at his very best form, when he's at his absolute best, as he was in the first sort of third of the season, James Maddison could have been useful in this team. In terms, he's also more of a final third guy, but he's someone, when he drops deep, he can pick up the ball, he can find some passes, he can open some things up. But of course, with his form in the second half of the season, you can't really justify his inclusion. I think it's completely understandable that Southgate dropped him. But we are in a situation now where England have to unlock a tight, well-organized defense and progress the ball through the midfield. They just, like, I don't, who is meant to do that in that area of the field? I was hoping Bellingham could kind of, like, really take charge, but this game was not good for Team Bellingham, unfortunately. And it made me think back to early in Southgate's reign, World Cup 2018, there was a huge focus on set pieces. I wonder if they're still doing that, because that could be a way to get around this in these sort of situations against teams that are well organized. But the thing is, you do actually need to put some kind of attacking moves together to actually win the corners. They had two corners in this game. Against Serbia, they had just one. So even if they worked on set pieces, it's kind of difficult. I used to have this idea about England. Actually, their best chance with this generation to win a tournament would actually just be to spend a ton of time working on set pieces, and I mean a ton. Just you put all your energy into set pieces, and then start Jack Grealish. Ideally start with a back three, so you have an extra big defender on the pitch, as many tall boys as you can muster, and then just have Grealish there and use his sort of unbelievable ability to win fouls here, there, and everywhere. Just get it to Grealo and he will win the foul somewhere, and then send up the big boys. Like, that would be Big Sam's Moneyball England. Like, Billy Bean would love this. This is properly gaming the system here. I honestly think that could have worked. Anyway, it's not happening. This was such a bad performance. There's going to be a lot of angst in the press now, because it was bad in such a familiar way, not passing the ball properly in midfield, and then you can see the anxiety as the game grew on. They were not confident, and I think Southgate admitted after the game that they were anxious, and they're going to come under even more pressure now, which is super helpful when they're very anxious. So it's a real test for Southgate and some of the more experienced players in the squad to just kind of, I think they need to, like, play ping pong or play around in the pool, or just, I'm not going to say have a drink, because these guys don't drink as much as players used to do back in the day, but they need to just have a complete circuit breaker and have, like, a team building day out or something, and just relax and have fun ahead of the Slovenia game, because they looked like they were not enjoying themselves at all in this game, and I think that affects the performance pretty negatively. Slovenia, who we have seen, are capable of putting together some pretty coherent defensive performances. So obviously England are massive favourites in that game, but it's not a complete given. Now, if England draw against Slovenia, and let's say Denmark thump Serbia, which, given the state of the Serbs, is not entirely impossible, England could finish second in the group, which, if we look at the bracket, runners-up in Group C faces the winners of Group A, which is almost definitely going to be Germany. So we'll get Germany in the last 16. I think that would be bad news for the English, I have to say. So England, not great performance-wise, possibly ominous for their situation in the group, but should probably be fine, because again, they should be Slovenia. But wow, so many familiar failings. And I think the coming few days are a huge test of Gareth Southgate's abilities as a leader of men, because that group needs to chill out. So many anxious people, so many small little technical errors in the second half. I got sort of Roy Hodgson, Capello era England vibes out of this. So they need to do something. They need to do something. Last game of the night. God, this has gotten to be a long pod, but I mean, we had to get that out of our system after that awful England performance. I know most of you guys watched it, if not everyone. But last game of the night, so much better. Spain versus Italy. And the first 20 minutes of that was just like a tonic of football. After watching England kind of laboring, to failing to create anything at all, the ease with which Spain moved the ball around was like, yes, this is what football should look like. And I tweeted as well, this game was just a great collection of midfielders who all passed the ball better than any of England's midfielders. There's so many of them around here. And we saw them more for Spain, of course. They completely dominated the first half and just they were really terrific. They were so quick, so exciting, much more forward-thinking than we've seen before. Again, all the things we said about Spain after the first round, it still stands. This is a genuinely different Spanish team. It's lovely to see. And the 1-0 goal, again, this sort of dichotomy of either a banger or a comedy mishap seems to continue. This was an own goal. Ton of those so far in the tournament. And Italy did get a little bit better in the second half, but really, it would have been a travesty if they'd have gotten anything out of this. They mounted some kind of late sort of rally, but Spain were so much better. And Nico Williams, what a player. Our friend Tor has, of course, flagged him up successive years on his list, and rightly so. According to Phil Kitromolidis, excellent La Liga reporter, his release clause is €50 million. Now, that is still a big number, but we have certainly seen Premier League clubs spend money of that quantity on far less promising players than Nico Williams. I suspect there will be some offers coming in from him this summer. Spain continue to look like the best team of the tournament, and they probably had the toughest schedule so far, right? With Croatia and Italy, I think that's fair to say. Interesting to hear from Spalletti after the game. I see he has quotes here as translated by the Football Italia website. He says, "It was clear from the start that they were much sharper than us. If you don't react at the same speed, it all becomes more difficult. When it's Spain who have this ability to target you quickly, it becomes doubly difficult. It is a simple analysis. They were quicker than us in their choices, in their pressing, in working together, and it all comes down to the fact that we weren't as sharp as them. When the legs don't move and you don't have the right distances between players, character can only take you so far. We were always stretched out, and every time we won the ball back, we lost it again. Our choices were not precise, our reaction was always a bit lacking in logic," says Spalletti. Which all sounds, yeah, that felt like the game I saw on TV, for sure. This quickness that Spain have in their action was very, very noticeable. And the fact that they keep the pitch so spread out with the wingers, making the pitch wide, so there's space to work in. I mean, England were often trying to do things very, very quickly against Denmark, but against a very compact team. And you can't really spread the field out in the same way because you have Phil Foden on left wing who isn't staying there, he's coming inside, and you have a right-footed fullback who doesn't really create any width, so it all kind of becomes really narrow. Anyway, we've moved away from England now. Enough venting about England. Spain, very fun to watch, full of energy, full of ideas. Group stages are not always a great indicator of anything. I mean, the history of these tournaments are full of teams who have played great stuff in the group stage and then fall over in the knockouts. That happens. But it's also not a bad thing to be playing well at this stage. And yeah, Spain, the most convincing team so far for me. Very intrigued to see how France fare versus the Netherlands tomorrow. Our goal scorer thing. I mean, the Mitrovic, when he put that finish into the bar, come on. I've had a couple of bad picks here. I will accept blame for that. But Lukaku having two disallowed, Mitrovic hitting the bar, Shaqiri then getting benched and then doing the exact thing I thought he was going to do when he was eventually let loose. I feel like the gods of football have not fully been on my side here. I feel like we're due a break with this feature. So tomorrow, I'm going to start deploying a little bit of like football tactic logic here as well, instead of going vibes or whoever's the most famous striker. That's kind of been what we've been oscillating between so far. France, I think France are going to have a good time against the Dutch. I'm targeting the French as goal scorers tomorrow. We don't know yet if Mbappe is playing, is what makes this kind of interesting. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to back Antoine Griezmann to get a goal tomorrow. And I have a specific reason for this, is that even if Mbappe plays, like, the Dutch defense is pretty good. They have good defenders there. And I think Koeman is a pragmatist. I think they'll be quick to drop off. I think they'll be very wary of Mbappe's speed. Koeman is not the sort of Peter Bosch-style crazy attacking Dutch guy. He's much more a pragmatic Dutch guy. I think we'll see a back three. I think we'll see a Dutch team that's very quick to protect themselves against the speed of Mbappe. But what I don't love about Holland, as you know, is their midfield. There's not enough defensive fibers in that midfield for my liking. I'm not convinced that they will do a diligent enough job tracking runners and closing down people around the edge of the box. So I think there's a fair chance we'll see a goal from midfield for France in this game. So it then makes sense that that will fall to Griezmann, who didn't have a great game against Austria. Perhaps he suffered a little bit with the Austrians being so aggressive. I don't think the Dutch will press them with any kind of the same aggression that we saw from Austria. So I think he'll have more time to work. And I can see a Griezmann finish from the edge of the box, or maybe a free kick or something like this. I believe in Grisou. I think he will could be back with a vengeance. More football tomorrow, including this very fascinating Dutch v France showdown, which as I speak about it, I get kind of more and more intrigued by. What a long episode. I do apologize, but there was a lot of England stuff we needed to get out of our system, and by us, I mean me. Thanks for listening again. I'll make another effort at keeping it shorter tomorrow. We'll see how that goes.